Calling the State Affairs Committee to order at 4:31 p.m. Thursday, 16 March 2017 in the Greenberg Room in the Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Wu?
Here.
Representative Sakoff? Representative LeBue?
Here.
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Peck?
Here.
Representative Judge, Representative Knopf, Chair Chris Tompkins.
Here, and with six members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you all for making the time, given these are long days and not yet done yet. Today, we have a consolidated agenda, House Bill 175, the first hearing relating to a popular vote compact. It's my hope, if time allows, also to bring up House Bill 1 and adopt a CS, which has been previously discussed as a working document, to have it on the record, but not to deliberate in any serious manner on HB 1. So really just HB 175 today. As mentioned, this is the first hearing. Representative Fansler is presenting a bill on the fifth floor right now, but we have with us Jill Yorty, staff to Representative Fansler, to introduce the bill briefly, as well as Barry Fadum, who's invited testimony and a guest today to the committee, also to take questions. So at this time, I'd invite Ms. Yorty and Mr. Fadum, if you'd care to join, to come up to the witness stand and present the bill and take questions. And I should just add, Mr. Fadum, thank you for flying into Juneau today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and Chair Chris Tompkins, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Jill Yorty, and I'm staff to Representative Zach Fansler, the primary sponsor of this bill. I'm here to present House Bill 175, the U.S. Presidential Election Compact, commonly known as the National Popular Vote Bill. I will keep my presentation short because we have Mr. Barry Fadum of the National Popular Vote here to provide testimony and answer questions that the committee may have. This bill really gets to the core of what a vote means. Voting is a right, a responsibility of each citizen. It's how we most directly make our voices heard in the decision-making processes of this country. Voting is a sacred right that many men and women have died for and struggled to gain the right to vote. There needs to be a reciprocation from the system to voters, a trust that every vote has equal weight and consideration in electing our highest officials. The current system favors swing states where there is nearly an equal internal division of voter preference and a winner-take-all method of awarding electoral votes. Alaska is not a swing state, and under the current system, our votes are consistently undervalued. Representative Fansler introduced this bill to start a conversation here in Alaska about how we can ensure that every vote is equal. The bill would ratify a compact intended to grant the presidency to the candidate who receives the most votes nationwide by allocating Alaska's electoral votes to that candidate. The compact only takes effect when states representing a majority of the nation's electoral votes, 270, have individually ratified the compact. Currently, 10 states and the District of Columbia have ratified this compact, representing a combined total of 165 electoral votes. An additional 15 states have passed the National Popular Vote Bill through at least one legislative body. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to hear HB 175.
Mr. Fadum, if you could put yourself on the record and state any affiliation.
My name is Barry Fadum. I've had the honor of serving as president of National Popular Vote since the organization was formed in 2005. And thank you very much for the introduction. What I wanted to focus, at least my remarks on, are the specific benefits to Alaska under the national what we believe under the national popular vote system. But before I start, we're only here for one reason, because the Founding Fathers in Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution gave you the exclusive right to make this decision. So how the electoral votes of Alaska should be awarded is totally up to you. So the frame for the question, I think, today is what system of awarding electoral votes is in the best interest of Alaskans and Alaskan voters? And I hope to make a presentation that will convince you that versus the current system as to national popular vote, that Alaska voters would be much, much better off under the national popular vote system. I'm going to cite four specific positive benefits that we believe occur under national popular vote and how they would vote, affect Alaska. The first one, and maybe the most dominant positive benefit for Alaskan voters, is that an Alaskan voter's vote for president would actually count. And how would an Alaskan voter know that, that when they cast their vote for president, it counted? Well, when they got up on a very cold election day morning, whether it was Juneau, as I've traveled around the country, I've been using Beaver, Alaska, which I learned a little bit about a couple months ago, 60 residents on the Arctic Circle. And as I make this presentation to other states, yes, it is true that a vote cast in Beaver, Alaska would count just as much as a vote cast in Miami, Florida, or Canton, Ohio. And how does a voter in Alaska really know that their vote counted when they got up on a very cold morning and went and voted? They're home watching the election returns that night, and they're running the national totals on the TV. 22,485,000 for this candidate, 32 million for the other candidate. They can look at that total and know their one vote counted. It's in the total. So now for the first time, an Alaskan voter would understand that their vote for president really did count. Another side benefit I'll just mention quickly is, can you imagine in Alaska voting for president and actually voting before the East Coast TV stations call the election? Under national popular vote, this election is not going to be called, and we're not going to know who the winner is until all the votes come in all 50 states. For those of us who live on the West Coast and have been constantly barraged with election returns before we even the polls close in our state, that would change under national popular vote. The second significant benefit to Alaskan voters is that there will be a campaign under national popular vote in all 50 states. In the 2016 election, 94% of all the election events occurred in 12 states. So when you do the math, that means 38 states, including Alaska, did not participate in the presidential election. Under national popular vote, we believe there will be a 50-state campaign, which means there will be campaign activities in all 50 states. There's no place in the country that does not have TV and radio. So every voter in every state is going to have the opportunity to hear the presidential candidates talk about issues. And perhaps even more importantly, in the 2016 election, neither candidate of either party ever mentioned the word environment. Well, if you're campaigning in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and the Rust Belt, you don't talk about the environment. But if you're not campaigning in states like Alaska and California and Idaho and Wyoming and all the states that care about the environment, you get a situation where presidential candidates don't come to Alaska and they don't talk about issues relevant to Alaska voters. So in a national popular vote, we think Alaskans actually get exposed to campaign issues and have a chance to learn about what their candidates are offering. Third positive effect, currently under the current system, both national parties pump in millions of dollars into the 12 battleground states to build infrastructure and for grassroots activities. Under national popular vote, with a 50-state campaign, the national parties will be redistributing, reallocating some of that money to all 50 states. So under national popular vote, we believe, and I think our belief is shared by the League of Women Voters, for example, that you'll see a tremendous increase in grassroots activities in all 50 states. And when you build structure, the presidential election every 4 years certainly is the most election with the most sizzle. It gets everyone involved, gets everyone caring, and you build structure for that that is in existence for all 4 years. So grassroots involvement is another positive effect. And the fourth one I will cite, in 2012, I don't have the 2016 figure, $2.1 million was raised by both parties in Alaska. And I think we can fairly assume that every dime of that money raised in Alaska was exported out to the battleground states. Why would you spend money raised in Alaska to inform Alaskan voters when it's already predetermined how Alaskans are going to vote in the election? So at the end of the day, we think that if you compare the how Alaska fares under the current system versus how they would fare under the national popular vote, we think the national popular vote system would be much to the advantage of Alaskans. And I've just mentioned the four campaign-related positive reasons for Alaskans. Let me mention one other that's outside the campaign. Three books came out last year, so the data is absolutely there and available for folks to look at. But it would be no surprise, I think, anyone here that battleground states do better with the president of the United States than non-battleground states. The data shows that battleground states receive 7% more presidentially controlled grants, twice as many disaster declarations, and numerous other favorable actions from the president, as detailed in these books. So another reason, as Alaska competes with other states to get the attention of the president for issues and projects that are important to Alaskans, if every state's a battleground state, states don't get preference simply because the president of the United States needs them in 2 or 4 years. So I would turn to the frame of the question, what's in the best interest of Alaska? We think the national popular vote proposal is. I'm going to, in 2 minutes, because I know you've had a long day, I know you're going to be taking public testimony next week or when you convene again. I just want to mention 4 issues very quickly that I know you're going to hear about, and I just want to highlight them for you so that at least you've heard some background on it. The first one is small states. As I travel this country and testify before legislative committees, I hear more often than any other issue associated with our project that the current system benefits small states, that the founding fathers and all the compromises that they did and they came up with a solution, Electoral College, that it was to benefit small states. Let's just take a quick snapshot of small states. There are 13 small states with 4 electoral votes or less. 6 are red, 6 are blue, and the only battleground small state is New Hampshire, which in 2016 received 21 presidential campaign visits. The other 12 states, 0. And that's been the way it has been in the small states for probably the last 40 years, and it's not going to change. The 6 small states that are red are very red, and the 6 blue states that are blue are very blue. So under the current system, small states are really among the most punished group of states in the country. And I will point out to you that 4 small states, have adopted the National Popular Vote Compact. Those are Hawaii, District of Columbia, not a state, Rhode Island, and Vermont. So the thought that somehow the current system is helpful to small states is just absolute factually wrong. And I offer you the proof. A second thing you're going to hear, I think, in the coming weeks as we debate this issue, is that a national popular vote, won't all the campaigning be confined to big cities? Campaigns will be conducted only in Los Angeles and New York, in other big cities like that. Well, the answer to that question is no, and we have evidence of that, much evidence of that. First of all, this country, the 50 largest cities of this country comprise only 15% of the population. 15% of this country is rural, that's 30. The other 70% is in the suburban areas. So big cities don't control elections today. And the best evidence, let me just give you an example. So in Ohio in 2012, there were 73 visits by the candidates. And I have a little map here. You can't see all the dots. But when you campaign for a president in a state right now, you campaign everywhere. You don't just campaign in the cities. The other last factor I will give you is that just from a cost point of view, TV and radio ads are available in all 50 states, obviously. Cost of per vote, media cost in New York City, 5.2 cents. Indianapolis, which is the 25th largest media market, is 4.0 cents. And Fort Smith, Arkansas, the 101st market, 3 cents. So as you enter into smaller states and rural areas, the cost of TV and radio ads drops dramatically, making it obviously very important to both parties to campaign everywhere. Cut these last two short. In fact, the only other one I will mention just very quickly is the issue of recounts. And will we ever, under national popular vote, will we have a president in a timely manner? Or is it possible that recounts will go on and on in numerous states? And in fact, we may not know who the president of the United States is until months into the next year. Answers, no. There's a federal law on the books that requires every state to submit what is called a certificate of ascertainment by the Safe Harbor Day, which is usually 6 days before the Electoral College meets in December. And by that date, all states have to provide the statement as to the count. That is why in 2000, when the U.S. Supreme Court said, Florida, you're done. There's no more recounts. You have to stop now. That was because of a federal law that requires all states to report their counts. So the idea of endless litigation, tying up the presidency for months and months, is just not factually correct. So with that, I think I should stop, and thank you very much for your time, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fadum. Low A, got it. And I see some hands. I believe Representative Johnson may have been first. Johnson, you have a question.
Right, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have to probably, I can just hear my father's voice, although he's long gone, in the back of my head saying things like, well, we're just kind of really glad in Alaska we don't see all those candidates up here. But it may very well be in the information, but how would this affect the electoral? I mean, we pick our House and our Senate. We have three, which, you know, obviously probably for Alaska as much or more than anyone, gives us perhaps more representation in the Senate.
Well, if I understand your question, this obviously doesn't affect anything but the vote for president, so it doesn't have any impact on the Senate or anything like that. I thought you were going to ask, though, in front of our book says a state-based plan. Many times we're asked, well, why don't you do this the right way, which is defined in some people's minds as a federal constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College. The response to that is, to achieve national popular vote, it's not necessary to amend the federal constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College. So that is why this is a state-based solution. If the legislatures of this country want to respect what we think is the will of the people for a national popular vote, they have the tools to do that, simply because the Founding Fathers gave the states that exclusive right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, thank you.
Representative Bridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like the Electoral College. I think it's good for Alaska. I think, you know, we've got, we all came into the Republic supposedly on equal footing, irrespective of whether you're a Rhode Island or an Alaska that's, more than twice the size of Texas. So, in my view, the Electoral College has provided Alaska, where there are two senators. We have the same number of senators that the state of California does. I look to the finality of the Electoral College in that it does, they get together and they they do the votes. It had some uncertainty this last time. It worked itself out. I just can't see how this is good for Alaska. We look at the amount of activity that happens today in states that are in contention, if you will, highly populated states that are in contention, and I don't see that change in one way or the other. But I view the fact that we do have winner take all approach here that we're all in, and I think it's been good for Alaska. I think recognizes the fact that we do have two U.S. senators, and I think that that's served us well, and I'm at a loss for why this, a move this way would be constructive and helpful for the state. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I appreciate the question. I'd really like to separate, though, your U.S. Senate representation. I totally agree with what you said about your U.S. Senate representation. But let's put that over here for just a second, because what we're talking about here is your representation in the presidential election. And my point back to you is that I don't know how you can conclude that Alaska has been treated well under the Electoral College in the presidential election, because you've never played or participated in a presidential election. Under national popular vote, our argument is that every vote in every state will count. So therefore, an Alaska vote, this number may not be right, 528,000, something like that, registered voters in Alaska. The closest presidential election we ever had was Kennedy and Nixon in 60. So 120,000 is what separated them. But I will guarantee you that both parties would be very interested in talking and obtaining the votes of over 500,000 Alaska voters. Under the current system, they're never coming. They don't care about Alaska because it's already decided how Alaska's going to go. So I guess my response back to you is I appreciate the senator but separating that out, Alaska has zero influence under the current system in the presidential election. That's what we would like to try to change.
Follow up. How do you think the results or the outcome of the last presidential election may have been influenced if the national popular vote was in place rather than the current system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I have great respect for President Trump's comment that if the national popular vote system had been in place, he would have campaigned differently. He did not campaign in his home state of New York, for example. So would he have received more votes on a national popular vote basis if the system had been in place? Maybe he could have. We'll never know. He's tweeted on a number of occasions that, bring it on, let's do the national popular vote, but then he's tweeted back that, well, I kind of liked it because I just won. So I'm not sure what he's going to do about it. But in terms of the current system, no one can look at this last election and judge what would have happened under a national popular vote because the campaign was not conducted that way. So I respect the fact that President Trump won the presidency under the rules in place at the time. He is the absolute justified winner. I'm not a supporter of – anyway, he's our president because he won under the current system. Would he win in 2020 if it were the national popular vote? We sure would like to find out, as all Americans would, and I think he would like to find out too. I think he might like to prove that, yes, I can win the most votes in all 50 states, but only if there's a 50-state campaign.
Can you follow up, Representative?
I'm not sure you answered the question, but I realize that, you know, I just was wondering if given the votes, if this program had been in place, how would that have broke out?
I mean, be honest, Mr. Chairman, Representative, if this system had been in place for this election, the electoral votes of the states who joined the compact would have gone to the winner of the national popular vote, and that was Hillary Clinton by 2 or 3 million. But that's not the system that was in place, and there wasn't a 50-state campaign. I don't think we can draw any conclusion from how President Trump would have done. But I do respect his statement that he only campaigned, as did Hillary Clinton, in 12 states. What would have happened in this election if both candidates had campaigned in all 50 states and then we decided whoever got the most votes in all 50 states won? We'll never know, but we're hopeful that maybe we can find out if this is in place by 2020.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I was wondering, you had mentioned that the compact has been passed in a certain number of states. Is there any deadline in which other states needed to adopt this compact, or it goes away, the states that have adopted it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is no time limit. So there have been compacts in the past that, to meet the requirement, it happened 20 or 30 years later. So the states that have passed this, so there are 12 states plus the District of Columbia that have passed this, actually 11 states plus the District of Columbia that have passed it, what their law books look like, this law is on the books, but it says does not go into effect until the compact goes into effect, so the existing state law controls. Gotcha. But there's no shelf life for the
Thank
compact.
Thank you.
And we'd like to acknowledge Representative Fansler. Thanks for joining us. Representative Johnson, I just because we've kind of gone all the way around, I think Representative Wohl may have a question. Yeah, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fathom, so I'm trying to imagine what a presidential campaign would look like in a popular vote scenario, because you mentioned that in the modern presidential campaign, and I don't know, maybe after this question you can enlighten us as to what the presidential campaign looked like at the time of the Electoral College was created. But in a modern presidential campaign, if I'm campaigning on a popular vote basis, you're asserting that I would go to all 50 states. If I'm trying to get as many votes as possible, for example, I may not go to a pancake cookout or pancake bake out in rural Iowa. Or I may not go to rural Texas to a barbecue joint. If I only have 50 states is a lot, and this is a big country. And, you know, if I'm campaigning for a year or a year and a half or whatever, bus tour and all that stuff, I would go to heavy population centers and try to reach large groups and large cities, and I may not go to the rural areas. And I think, was that the original intent of Electoral College? Not just for small states, but to give sort of more rural places as much influence as sort of Philadelphia, Washington, Boston, New York, you know, the big urban power centers at the time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for the question. I'm not going to pretend to be an Electoral College historian. I've read the Federalist Papers. I've read all these things. It's such a different time. I have the number here, but I think the 9% or less than 10% of Americans at that time lived in cities. I mean, it was a rural country at that time. And you've all heard the stories about people worrying about how does things get communicated, the news, those type of things. Maybe we just should have a bunch of very smart people who we trust make this decision for us. And that was some of the flavor. But let me respectfully point out that the great state of Massachusetts has changed how it awarded its electoral votes 11 times during its history as a state, and ending up with national popular vote. And I think the brilliance of the Founding Fathers was by giving the state legislatures the right to make these decisions, state legislatures change. And as times change, feelings change and needs change. So what we have here is a situation where you have the ability to make the national popular vote. The only thing I will challenge you on, I don't want to. I may have put too much emphasis, perhaps, on candidate visits. That's just one indicia. But look, the real presidential campaign that's conducted in this country is really through the media, through television and radio. And that's why, if you're a presidential campaign and you're looking at big cities, small cities, you're going to do TV and radio ads everywhere because, first of all, the cost can be lower in the smaller areas. But a vote cast, again, I go back to Beaver. Can you imagine what a vote in Beaver, Alaska, is exactly equal to a vote cast in Miami, Florida? Would you not go after the vote in Alaska? No state gets written off. No area gets written off. Campaigns will be conducted in the urban areas, the suburban areas, and the rural areas.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up. So I guess basically what you're saying is the current system of the Electoral College and the laws around it are fine in that it allows the state legislatures independently to determine. So you wouldn't even necessarily advocate abolishing the Electoral College because you, in case for some reason times change to go back, this system allows the state legislatures to decide to do something like the popular vote compact, but also to echo Representative Johnson's sentiment. I'm not sure I'd want to be bombarded with television ads. I'm sort of glad we're not up here, but so be it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're exactly right when you talk about the Electoral College. Today, the Electoral College is a rubber stamp for 50 individual state votes. When the Electoral College meets in December, there are never any surprises, and they cast their votes accordingly. All that happens under national popular vote is that the Electoral College becomes a rubber stamp for the national popular vote. So we've got a number of Republican legislators who have supported us in the states. In fact, I just want to mention Arizona. Last year, two-thirds of the Republicans in the Arizona House and two-thirds of the Democrats in the Arizona House voted for the national popular vote, and the reason being that they understood that as a non-battleground state. But what's interesting is the number of Republican legislators who said they would never vote for anything to abolish the Electoral College for the very reason, Representative, that you just cited. Why would a state legislature want to give up a power granted to them by the Founding Fathers? This right and your right to enter into interstate compacts are two of the explicit rights given states. Why would a state legislature want to give up that right? If there are unintended consequences for national popular vote, if we're not as smart as we think the project is and something is not good, well, what happens? Legislatures come back in, they withdraw from the compact, it goes away. If you were to abolish the Electoral College and somehow didn't like what happened thereafter, the only way you're going to fix that is by another federal constitutional amendment. And by the way, just on timing again, the last federal constitutional amendment that I got close was the ERA initiative back in the 70s, and there's not been one since that got even close. So thank you for that.
Two other questions on this side of the table, though I'm going to interject quickly on that question of sort of rural versus urban. I mean, it's my understanding from you're talking about presidential candidate visits in Ohio, that they're kind of speckled across Ohio. And if Ohio is just a microcosm of the U.S., if there was a true 50-state national campaign, logic would seem to dictate if this urban strategy was in fact advantageous, that the candidates would just post up in Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus and never bother to go out into the prairies of Zanesville or wherever. Could you speak to how those visits
Mr. Chairman,
work out?
Thank you for the question. The best example I will cite is 2004. We're in the great state of Ohio, and if Kerry had gotten 50,000 more votes in Ohio, he would have won Ohio, and he would have won the presidency. If you look at Ohio, he campaigned in all the big cities, everyone, Canton, Toledo. But the Republican candidate, Bush, campaigned in every part of the state and not just in the big cities. And that is, I mean, that we know what will happen in a 50-state campaign because we know what happens in the 12 battleground states that they campaign in now. They do not campaign just in the big cities because big cities do not control that state's elections.
Representative Johnson?
Representative Wohl hit on a lot of the things I was thinking, but I just can't wrap my mind around this. It doesn't make sense to me for Alaska. And I guess, I mean, why would a candidate go to Beaver? Well, I don't want to end there. There's more to it. They would go to Beaver. There's however many people there, say 75. I don't know. I don't really know the population offhand. It's expensive to get 60. Okay. So it's expensive to get there. It's going to take several days travel to do that. And they say get 60 votes. Why would they ever come to Alaska and do that in the first place? I mean, if those 65 votes are worth the same, or at that point we're talking about 50 or something, why not stay in Seattle where you can hit all the urban, you can hit that urban area? I mean, maybe that was just answered, but somehow I just can't wrap my mind around.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, you are absolutely 100% correct. I am not going to sit here and say that when we have, whatever, 287 visits, that there's going to be one visit. You may recall one president who made the vow that he would visit all 50 states. And I think that was President Nixon in 1960, and he was here when he should have been in the battleground states, perhaps. But it's not the – I feel like I've done a disservice to my presentation. Let's just forget presidential visits because that's not – I mean, it's nice. There'll be some hype. There's hype. Newspaper coverage gets people excited. But in terms of a presidential campaign, it's media. It's TV and radio. And that's really what we're talking about, TV and radio that every Alaskan voter, whether it's Beaver or Juneau, has a chance to hear the candidates talk about issues, and I think issues important to Alaska. That's the biggest change. But I want to go back to the first reason that I said this is great for Alaska. It's for the voter. It's for the Alaskan voter who wants to know that their vote counted in the presidential election. They know that today it doesn't count. But under national popular vote, they're going to be able to see that it actually counted, that it really meant something. And under the current system, that's just not there. So I agree with you on the visits. But
Bala?
Thank you. I just want to – I did feel like this last election that our vote counted. I mean, I a lot of times know, especially when they announced the vote before – I mean, announced the president before we even got our polls closed. But just on a side note, I will say that the last president to visit Palmer, my hometown, it was President Kennedy. So, but he wasn't president at that point.
Can I ask you what year that was?
Huh?
What year that was?
I believe it was 1959. Yeah, I got lots of historical photos.
Well, according to what you're saying, Mr. Payton, we might expect to hear TV and radio ads about where the presidential candidates stand on the King Cove Road or Anwar. That'd be lovely. Let's see. I think we had Representative Ledoux, then Representative Birch, then Representative Tuck.
Okay, so you've absolutely convinced me that if I owned a newspaper or if I owned a television station, that I think it would be absolutely great to have national popular vote. But as, you know, just a person, I guess I'm not so totally sure that being barraged with not really discussions of issues, because everybody knows that issues really aren't discussed in television commercials. It's all about sound bites. Why would I want to, as a person who doesn't have stock in either a newspaper or a television or a radio company, why would I consider that advantageous?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you very much for asking that question, because this is the part that I get a little misty-eyed about, which is the voter. The United States voter and how they feel about the presidential election. Let me respond this way. Voters don't – I know you may sit up here and talk about being barraged by big TV and radio ads, but honestly, the voters that we have engaged with and the voters – the spontaneous voter support we're getting for National Popular Vote, they do want to hear these ads. They do want to hear about these issues. They don't want to be ignored. They do want their vote to count. That's what motivates – when you talk about from a personal point of view, the voters that we have been in contact with and the voters that we talk to care passionately about this country and care passionately about the presidential election. And they are very unhappy because they realize that if you're not – why should you be punished by where you live? Just by the fact of your geography, why should that mean that your vote for president really doesn't count? So that's why it took us 3 years to go through the League of Women Voters national endorsement of a position. If you go to their office in D.C., on their wall, their original charter from 1920, National Popular Vote was one of their first goals that was on their charter. And groups like all the groups that have supported National Popular Vote from Common Cause, et cetera, the voters care. They do want a presidential campaign. I don't know if that was responsive, please.
And through the chair, this is Jill Yorty again for the record. In terms of a presidential campaign investment in all 50 states, I'd like to speak to that briefly. There's a lot more resources that go into a presidential campaign than just radio and television, and that's especially important here in Alaska, because when you get on-the-ground campaign staff, when you're actually getting volunteers going door-to-door because every vote matters, that's when the presidential campaigns are getting feedback directly from Alaskan voters about what matters here. And when every vote is the same, has the same weight on a national scale, that means that they're actually interested in what those voters are saying.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good conversation. I will say that, I was going to respond a little bit to how I see the popular vote happening if Alaska adopts it. Isn't that we'll have the president visiting Beaver as much as we would have the president voting Anchorage or Fairbanks? Because right now we don't get any attention from them, and it just goes back to the issues that we have at hand as well that need attention. I mean, we had President Bush with a Republican-led Senate, Republican-led House, and Anwar still didn't get any attention. You know, seriously, it didn't get any attention at all. And, I mean, you would think that those were the conditions to get Anwar opened up for expiration. And then going back to the King Cove Road and everything else, another thing is that we do not, we can almost demand, if we got special attention, to get some of the lands owed to us by the federal government as well. So it's not just about the vote for me that I can see here in the story. It's really about having attention overall and having our issues addressed and being significant and not just a 49th state that's way out of the middle of nowhere that people don't even know if we're part of Canada or part of the United States. So that's just a comment, and I was only going to respond to how I kind of see that coming together a little bit is just that what I see happening if we do this is instead of being in rural Texas, we'll be now going into urban Alaska. It would be a shift in how campaigns are run.
And Representative Birch, closing question.
Not so much a question. I've actually been to Beaver. Beaver was it's between Stevens Village and Fort Yukon, and we got our mail in Fort Yukon and frequently got in and out of there. But it was actually founded by a Japanese American who married an Inupiaq in Barrow and established the community when they were having some food issues. But the concern I have is. It's a weighting issue, and you start looking at the population center. I mean, you could put all of Alaska, all 750,000 of us, brothers and sisters, friends and family, it barely make a blip on the radar screen as a suburb of Los Angeles. And I think the concern I have is you get lost in the noise. I think the population centers. I think this would turn into a New York, California, show, and I think we'd be lost in the noise. I like the idea. I happen to be a proud deplorable, so I'm actually pretty happy with the outcome of the election. I think from the standpoint of trying to take a look at how that's going to shake things up, I'm concerned that it's going to diminish our ability to have an impact on a presidential election. So I appreciate your comments in our meeting and our prior discussion, but I think in looking out for my constituency and my people that elected me, I'm not personally convinced that we'd be better off in this manner. Thank you.
Any closing comments, Mr. Fadum or Ms. Yorty? And was there a closing interjection, Representative Johnson? And close. Okay, we'll do Representative Johnson, Representative Wall, and call it good.
My short interjection: if we were going to go through our family connections to Beaver,
this is important for the record.
But I do, and I have a couple, but I'll save those for another day. Thank you,
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if Alaska didn't join the compact, but you had enough states that tipped 270, then those, how would that work for the states that don't join?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, nothing would change in those states. States that don't join the compact would go about their business just like they do today under a winner-take-all, or if it's Maine and Nebraska congressional district. So you'd have a block of 270 that would go to the candidate who won the most votes in all 50 states, and he or she would receive additional electoral votes from other states who may have voted for him or her. The 270, that number guarantees that whoever gets that is president. Do we agree on that? So if states don't have a compact, nothing changes in those states, and they conduct their business the way they do today.
So quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the states that don't join the compact, the other states that form 270 would go the way of the popular vote. So say Alaska doesn't join, our vote would count only in the sense that it goes towards the popular vote, which is ostensibly what you want anyways.
Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely correct. The popular votes would go into that 50-state total, but your electoral votes would go to whoever won the most votes in your state if you did not join the compact.
Under that. Just real quick.
It's 5:15, so this can be the last.
I think that once you start getting to the 270, you'll find that more states will want to get on board because of that exact reason.
Well, on that tantalizing hypothetical, thank you, Mr. Fadum.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Yorty, for the presentation. I do want to hear a quick motion to adopt as a working document to put on the record the CS for House Bill 1. Is there a motion, Madam Vice Chair?
Yes, I move that House State Affairs Committee adopt CS30-LS0070/0 as a working document for House Bill 1.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. We'll visit that bill next week, and we have a full calendar next week, 10 different pieces of legislation. A couple of them are pretty formal and symbolic, or non-substantive and symbolic. And with that, we will adjourn at 5:16 p.m.